Hi, this is Phil Lairness. As we travel through the third decade of the 21st century, it's good to know that the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Editions continue to produce a minimum of 4 hours of weekly audio goodness on Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com.
Thank you. Well, if you're like me, you're just actually luxuriating in the sound of Pavan, initial track. I mean, we've got another one that's coming through as well. Yes, the icing is very much on the cake because Pavan, of course, played for us there by the Rich Meehan Trio. And we've actually got two of those fine folk who will be joining us now. One of them is already set and ready to actually go and is connecting in all manner of wonderful ways. And that's, of course, Paul Glover. How are you, Paul?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you doing today?
Excellent. We're okay, and what a wonderful slice of music. I mean, how come I've never actually heard? I mean, it's obviously my fault, quite clearly, but I've never heard of this terrific trio, this Berkshire-based jazz epic group of folk that you've actually got, and the magic that you've actually just produced.
Well, I mean, we're brand new trio. That Prelude is actually our debut release. Here's the man himself, Richard, appearing.
Hi, Rich. How are you?
Hi, how
Well,
you doing?
welcome to the Midweek Drive. Good to connect with you, good self.
Thanks very much. Yes, it's really a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having us.
It's a genuine delight to say. We were listening, to say, to one of your early sort of aspects there. We're going to hear Prelude, obviously, as the program proceeds. But we were listening to Pavan, and
Oh, wow.
obviously, I've heard about Gymnopédie, and I thought, well, Eric Satie did great stuff with Gymnopédie, but you've out-Sartied Eric Satie with respect to that. So great stuff.
Oh,
But
thank you.
again, in terms of the actual aspect of that, obviously you're based in Berkshire, not necessarily a place known for its jazz, although I could be wrong with respect to that. But share with us. I mean, let's come to you first, Richard, before we come back to Paul. Just talk to us about how you got together in the first place, and why this wonderful contemporary jazz with subtle flecks of
Hello.
electronica all impact on the listening pleasure.
Well, I think you're being a little bit unfair because actually there's a lot of great music that goes on in the Reading area, certainly. You can find yourself at the weekend listening to all manner of sort of live music made by really interesting people, sort of all doing their own thing. And certainly that's how we met. We met as part of that sort of very open way in which people seem to make music in Reading, sort of enjoying their jazz, enjoying their sort of rock and pop, and indeed they're classical as well. It's actually I think a really underrated place to live. And so we would have met as members of Reading University Big Band long after we were students. And then from then on we'd gone to do quite a lot of music together and sort of realized we were sort of useful and people to know and sort of helpful people to know each other. So that's how we met and did our music together.
But how this project got started actually was that, I mean, it actually came around with the talk of building Richard a website so that he could sell his skills as a composer. And I said to Richard, well, I'll help you out with the website, but you don't have enough content that really reflects the quality of your writing. So he actually wrote Suite Antique, and we went into the studio, and it was always going to be just to be go on Rich's website. But it ended up being so good, we were like, well, let's turn this into something. Let's go out, let's play it live, let's turn it into a piece of art rather than a bit of just marketing. And so it's sort of, been born in a really organic way. And here we are now working really hard on it, and being booked for festivals and all sorts of things going on. So it's really great.
And rightly so. I mean, again, it's just flying the flag. I mean, clearly up north, Lincoln or Teesside, we haven't appreciated the joys of what's been happening in Berkshire, but it's okay. We're on the case now, and we'll be sorting it through. Jazz is one of those, I often think, is it an acquired taste? To a certain extent, I think you almost have to live a bit of life before you can really appreciate jazz. Would you say that's a fair comment, Rich?
I see what you mean. I think the trouble with jazz is it's just a label of such broad music, often made with such different ideas. I mean, there's if you're taught jazz, you'll be taught about chords and keys and scales, and you'd be taught to make a certain mainstream sound. But it can be so much more than that. To me, jazz is something that is neither classical nor sort of pop music that is made. Putting the creativity of the individual at the center. Yes, rhythm is there and improvisation is there, but it's really about putting the creativity of the individual at the center. So perhaps you do actually need, we make a certain demand of the listener that they will, that's what they would sign down if they were going to listen to us. They were going to hear something which was about us as creative people. But above and beyond that, it doesn't need to be difficult. it doesn't have to be difficult. I mean, we hope that if we were to make demands of the listener, they would go along with it. We'd hope we'd find the listeners who would go along with it. But yeah, I think it's an interesting point, but jazz can be so many things that whether or not it's a difficult learning experience or one where you need to be enculturated, if you need to have a certain amount of listening experience or life to understand it, certainly it helps, but maybe you don't need it. I don't know.
Well, let's go back to Paul for a moment, because we've had a little preview of some of the awesome tracks that are coming up in this album. And one of them which caught my mind immediately was Gymnopédie, partly because I used to enjoy playing it on the piano, and Gymnopédie number 3 was my speciality. 1 and 2, you know, so, but 3 was fun. But it was simplistic, but it was very effective. And when you actually contrast, as I think I did, if I recall my grade 6 music at the time, that we have a situation whereby you have Scarlatti, which I always thought was a nightmare, insofar as people go all over the place, etc. And then you got this very simple, you know, slow, mellow, French, impressionist, Eric Satie composed piece. What was it that drew you to do that, or do this variation on Gymnopédie?
That's a question for Richard, really, because Richard's
okay. Yes. Well, let's go to Richard. You know, as I was asking it, suddenly I thought, actually, this is probably more a question for Richard, but never mind. Go, Richard.
Well, I mean, actually, truth be told, I was trying to write a saraband, which is sort of a stately dance with a suite antique. So we decided that we're definitely going to do something which was classical crossover. We definitely decided it was going to be look to the past as it looked to the future at the same time. And I was hoping that that third slow movement would be a saraband. But by the time I'd started to work through what the piano could do or what felt right or what chords and keys seemed to be coming naturally, it very much became something that echoed those Satie Gymnopédies. I mean, they're great pieces. They have this, you're right, they have this sort of aura about them, don't they? That comes out of the simplicity of how they write, how they're written. But yeah, I absolutely, that's how they came about. And yeah, they have a certain magic in spite of their simplicity, or maybe because of their simplicity, I think.
That's true. Well, this question is very much for Paul, because we're talking about your grounding drums that's actually working together. We'll also mention, of course, the warming bass from James Newman, of course, who's also, who can't be with us today, but, you know, it's good stuff for that. Or maybe he didn't want to. I don't know. What the hey? Hopefully it's not going to go from a trio to a duo just on the basis of a sort of system. But Paul, talk to us about your own musical career path and obviously web designing path as well, perhaps.
I mean, the web design, I don't do that much at all. I've only ever built my own. Anyway, in terms of drumming, like, you wouldn't, if you knew sort of what I'd done, you wouldn't sort of put me in this project, like, because for much of my career, I was touring with big progressive rock bands, hip hop, alt rock, some quite heavy stuff. I was Scroobius Pip's drummer for about 2 years, who's a well-known sort of spoken word artist, and that's kind of where I came from. But I sort of developed this love of jazz, and jazz was sort of like the thing that I was doing on the side as my passion. And sort of over time, I ended up sort of doing a little bit of folk and a little bit of jazz and a little bit of big band, which is where I met Richard. And then now is like sort of jazz is what I gravitate towards, and I guess, you know, and now I can call myself a jazz drummer because I'm, you know, on a record that's being released, and here I am, you know. Yeah, so I've had a very varied career.
I love the way you actually use the term record. How 20th century, I suppose vinyl is still there. What the heck? It's all good stuff. Although, will anybody ever say they were releasing a cassette single again? That's what I'd like to see. You know, no, perhaps not. the upcoming EP, of course, is entitled Sweet Antique. So Rich, again, back to yourself again. I mean, it's been described, as we said at the start, fusing elements of classical music with contemporary jazz and subtle flex of electronica and so on. Is there a kind of generic theme to the album that you're looking for? Or is it just a case of this is all just good music? Just listen to it.
Well, I hope, you know, when you're writing, you try to write things that you would want to listen to. You write things that are satisfying. You write things that seem right. But you also need to narrow your focus so that you know it's one thing and not just some sort of general thing you splatted out. So yeah, when I was thinking about this. I certainly know classical music very well. Paul can bring that prog element. You know, there is undoubtedly a prog element to what we do. I have a very good friend called John Bierman, who lives in Vancouver, who has a basement filled with more synthesizers than you've ever seen. And actually to bring him on board, and the fact that his work seemed to really tie the sound together, which means you play the piano in a slightly different way. And you want it to belong together as a set. You want it to be its own thing. But it really leads with what feels right. You're very much leading with, well, this seems to be the way it should work. This seems to be when the piano speaks back to me, these are the sounds that I seem to have the most in common with. These are the sounds where I really feel like I'm speaking to the piano when I play it. So I think that's where it comes from. That's how it gets its coherence as a set. It's what feels right. And these are the friends that I have and what they like to do when I'm talking to them as well. So I think it's all about the dialogue and how the dialogue forms and the piece.
The album was, of course, mixed by Mercury-nominated producer Jerry Diver. Did you have a collaborative relationship with Jerry, or was it a case of, well, just do for us what George Martin did for the Beatles? Just tell us what to do.
I don't think that's how Jerry works. I mean, he was an absolute joy to work with. He sent us the first thing, and when we... You're always a little bit nervous when you're working with someone who's sort of that high profile to say, well, actually, that's not quite how I'm feeling, or that's not quite what I intended. But actually, he was really brilliant with that. He wanted to know, is this what you wanted it to sound like? Is this what you hoped it would sound like? Am I getting this? And actually, he was very close from the outset, but being able
also,
to move it.
Before that process, you know, we had quite a lot of dialogue with him before he mixed. You know, we had recorded the EP in its entirety already. And then he'd heard, like, essentially the demo versions that were high-quality demo versions that were, you know, mixed and mastered demo versions. And then we re-recorded the whole thing, having arranged that he would then mix, you know, this recording of them. But even before we sent him the files, we had a sort of a back and forth with sending Spotify playlists of, like, what do you like the sound of? What do you want this record to sound like? And had, you know, a sort of a palette of sounds in a final playlist for him to listen to. And then we sent him the files. Then he mixed it, like, sort of as close as he wanted it to. And then we had this very futuristic thing where me and Richard were in two different locations and Jerry was in another location. And he then did a final tweak of a mix live where we all logged into this thing and we all had headphones on and we had a pass of the song. And then we all had our input of, like, well, let's change this and let's change that. And he changed the faders, like, in front of our very eyes and press play again. And we sort of had a final mix of the record. So... yeah, there was a lot of back and forth, a lot of dialogue, a lot of planning before we mixed it. And he totally lived up to his reputation of being, you know, a really, really excellent engineer.
And you talked about the process there of the production, which is certainly something which arguably is kind of unique to the last decade, the last 5 years in many ways. I mean, the way we're doing this interview is something which would have probably been unlikely pre-pandemic. I mean, okay, the likelihood we still do phone interviews, we still do various other things. Skype was actually around. But do you think that the technology impacts the jazz, or does the jazz also impact the technology? I mean, how do we kind of cross-reference that? Richard, one for you, I think, perhaps.
I was thinking about this today, and I think we've, to a certain extent, forgotten the pandemic with it going back to normal.
To Shanghai.
And we've almost forgotten that those 18 months seem to exist in a separate time, and we forget how much we've learned. I think it's already impossible to imagine what the world was like before, what it was like to talk on screens. And especially now we're getting back to living that everyday life where everything is in the right order and time seems to pass at least a reasonable speed. That's one of the things I really noticed during the pandemic. Time didn't seem to have any meaning. Weeks seemed to go by without anything happening. And sometimes things might only be 2 or 3 days ago and they seem like a million years ago. So I think, yes, we've probably learned a lot. I think we've forgotten that we were less tech savvy. I think we've forgotten that we used to use less text. Certainly,
the telephone.
Yes, telephone. I've certainly got a lot better at sort of mixing and editing. It was always something I knew how to do, but I've certainly got a lot better at it. So for the bits I need to do myself because of what we needed to do during the pandemic. So yeah, it probably has made an impact, but I really struggled to feel and taste the difference it made because it's now with us, just like COVID itself, I think.
I think to think about, if I'm thinking about your question a little bit, like this is it's an interesting project because like, you know, we've got a jazz trio, but we've also got the sounds from John Bierman that you would, like, I think most people would assume that we would, you know, track as the jazz trio and then we'd, like, create some sounds to go in between all those sounds. And that's not how it works. It actually works completely back to front where during the composition process, Richard sort of writes his ideas of the sounds and then sends them over to Canada to John Bierman, who creates all of the kind of the whiz, the bangs, the pops, the soundscapes, sends them back to us before we go into the studio. And we actually track to them whilst we're tracking the jazz trio. And then when we're playing live, it's a difficult thing that we, you know, we play along to, you know, backing tracks that we've created from what we've used from the John Bierman sounds. So we're all using a computer, like a, you know, in-ear monitoring, and we are fusing, you know, very modern things with a sort of an old traditional jazz trio. So those two things, you know, it comes with its own challenge of being able to listen to each other without, you know, things in your ears is you know, it's actually quite a big thing, problem to leap over. But yeah, we are sort of fusing the new and the old, I feel.
And of course, great for reducing the carbon footprint, which is, just imagine actually the air miles if you've been flying backwards and forwards from Canada to the UK. So on that basis, the carbon footprint has been diminished.
We are a very green band.
I've done a lot of work with John Bierman. I've been to visit him once, and most of that was by train. A sizable proportion of that trip across Canada was on a train for many days. Yeah.
Rich, it's all right. Don't worry. Your green credentials are fine. They're all sorted out in that place, which is wonderful. We're going to move on now to obviously have the new single. We're going to listen to it in full force, etc. Before we actually go into Prelude, which you might think, Prelude? You've already done the interview. Surely the Prelude should have come before the interview. I know. It's time. We're just mixing around from that. Would you like to talk us through why you've released this as a single and why obviously the album, which you must get if you've got any sense of wanting to be cool at all, Sweet Antique, of course. Talk to us, Rich, about Prelude and what things you had in mind when you were putting it together.
Well, Prelude is very much a set out of the stall for what comes next. Each of the subsequent tracks will pick up one element of what it does, the electronics, the sound, which is hopefully something a bit different, hopefully a bit unusual, but at the same time very accessible. And it sets out the sound world, it sets out the space in which the rest of what we're going to do for Sweet Antique is very much about. So we've got this little mantra that starts with those opening chords, which keeps recurring all the way through the piece. And then in between, we've got the way the piano interplays with Paul's drum work, with James's amazing funky playing, with John's sort of really wonderful evolving sound. And because it is... If you were to listen to the other pieces, you might when we did our launch gig, what was really heartening is that everyone brought their own understandings, their own musical experiences, the music they like, the music they've been listening to all their lives, their own particular niche likes, and that was how they listened to it. That was how they opened the door to it. And for Prelude, the idea is that you will listen to that and use your own musical experience to find those connections with those bits. And this of all of the pieces, is the one where you have to make those connections. Some of the other ones have other sort of... the Jakarta, in fact, was a great bit of fun, lots of real humour to it. And we're a band that can have...
Fun, you say?
Fun, yeah.
That was on the record.
And we can absolutely have fun. We're absolutely got the humour there, but something that is what's distinctive about what's to come. That's why we've released the Prelude first.
I love the fact you say about to wanting to return to the music you made as a late teenager. And I want to, Rich, actually put a question to both of you actually about this. What would the now adult Rich Meehan want to say to that late teenager if you could actually go back in time and say, look, just bear this in mind, son?
You could start first, I think, for this.
We're talking to your teenager, not mine.
I think what I would actually honestly say to the teenage Rich Meehan is you are entirely right to be yourself. You will, when you grow up and get older, be someone different. But I will always appreciate quite how sure of yourself you seem to be, in spite of the fact that as a late teenager, you're both extremely sure of yourself and completely at sea. And it's a really bizarre combination. I think that's true for pretty much everyone, you know, between the ages of sort of 15 to 19. Really sure of yourself, but you know, completely oblivious completely full of self-doubt. And I would just say that, you know, that was fine. That was absolutely all right. You will be someone different. Please don't be too disappointed about being someone different. But I do appreciate the person that you used to be and how that informs the person I now am.
And for Paul Glover Jr., what would your thoughts be, Paul?
Do some more practice.
Yeah, you can never get enough practice. That's the important thing. Life is full of the whole sort of practice side of things. Social media, obviously, you're all across. You can go to the richmeehantrio.com, presumably, as the website. Any particular preference? Are you Instagram folk? Are you sort of saying, no, we want the TikTok thing? What are the sort of the ways in which people can actually follow Richmond Meehan Trio?
We wondered about TikTok. We thought we may be getting a bit old for TikTok, but yeah, we're everywhere else you can find music being made.
Yeah, but I mean, Instagram's actually the preference. Like, I'm the one running the Instagram. Loving the Instagram. So come and DM us.
You're not thinking about going Meta and actually sort of taking full experience of the whole metaverse to come.
I mean, maybe we will have Richard. I'm sure will write some sort of 3D. thing
featuring unicorns, please. I'd like a unicorn in there. We don't have enough unicorns in jazz these days, I've often thought.
Oh, because of our virtual background, you can't see
exactly. Exactly, it's unicorn is there. Guys, it's been terrific connecting with your good self. I'm going to ask you in a few moments to actually introduce Prelude as we conclude the sort of piece. But I've got two final questions that are mandatory when it comes to the Midweek Drive, whether we're Midweek Drive live and it's the hybrid Zoom thing and you're feeding directly into the studio, or whether it's a pre-record like today, which will be released very shortly afterwards. In fact, you know, in the next few hours, basically. And we'll go to Rich first. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Oh, I've loved it. I mean, the opportunity to share what you do and to be asked of interesting questions. And sometimes you get asked a question you weren't expecting. And at that point, you learn something new about yourself, which is always brilliant. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And same question to Paul. Has it been okay for you, Paul?
Yeah, it's always good. And I find that we are... Like, and I've found the same with this interview as I have with previous interviews, that I tend to find out stuff about this very project and about Richard that he would never tell me just over a beer.
Yeah.
So, you know.
That's strange. It's exactly what Pamela Sue Mann, our regular co-host for New York Real Talk, an ace musician herself, often says as well. She can actually bring people on who are her friends and find out more about them because of the interview procedure. So it's good. It's therapy, really. But therapy via the medium of Zoom, which is all good.
I feel better. Yeah, I certainly do too.
So the next critical question is to both of you. Will you be kind enough to return? Will you come back in the not too distant future and join us once again on the Midweek Drive?
Oh, we'd love to. Thanks very much.
Absolutely love to.
Yeah.
Many thanks indeed. And now it falls to, you can do it as a duo. You can do it as an individual. You can do it Rich or Paul. Would you like to formally introduce what we're about to hear, which of course is the Rich Meehan Trios from the upcoming album Sweet Antique? Prelude, over to you, gentlemen.
Well, thanks very much for listening. Yeah, we are the Rich Meehan Trio, and this is the first track, the first cut of our EP, Sweet Antique, and this is The Prelude. Thank you.
The Secrets of the London Underground. It's back, yes, for a second series in which we explore some of those mysterious worlds that obviously are now into, well, pretty much the second or is it the third century? I don't know. But somebody who does know is certainly the awesomely talented London Transport Museum's very own Siddy Holloway. How are you, Siddy?
I'm very well, Alex. How are you?
Well, great to connect with your good self. And I was thinking, of course, the London Underground was the 19th century when it actually started. So here we are in the 21st. Understandably, there's an awful lot of mileage in more ways than one that actually have been produced in this whole series.
That's it. Well, I mean, I think, you know, the London Underground, as you say, was opened in 1863, so it's 159 years old. It's been around for quite some time, but also it's so fascinating because it's the world's first underground. It's grown very organically, which means that in the march of progress, there have been so many disused and closed parts of it that have just been forgotten by people simply because sometimes they just need to upgrade or change or close a station. And so that's, you know, we get to literally go into some of the most extraordinary places that sometimes have not been touched by people for, you know, 80 years. So this series is, I think, going to really excite everyone.
Much beloved, of course, of many fascinating writers for Doctor Who, Ben Aronovitch, of course. I mean, it's been a fertile ground for the imagination and science fiction in general to actually produce material. I mean, is this also the sense of the abandonment and yet it's submerged, it's unknown, we don't quite know what they were like?
Yeah, I think we've all got just a fascination with secrets and hidden places. I think there's something sort of almost childlike in us when we get to go through a door that we're not supposed to go through, or when you get to peek around a corner into something you're not supposed to see. And so getting to do that with the audience on the show is so exciting. I think that's why people get such fertile imaginations about it, because it is so sort of something you're not supposed to do, and it's a little bit naughty, and something you've always wondered about. And I think the underground in particular has just this kind of pull about it that really fascinates, I think, everyone, certainly does with me.
So this is the second series of Secrets of the London Underground. I mean, clearly there are an awful lot of things that are actually based within that whole field. Just talk us through your own particular highlights of the 10 episodes that are upcoming.
Oh gosh, it was so, there are so many, but I do have some that I truly thought was, they were sort of career highlights, honestly. Well, in the first series, we were really lucky in order to, you know, we were able to take people into some extraordinary spaces, but some of them were spaces that we knew really, really well, you know, be doing tours of them for, you know, several years and really familiar with some of those spaces. So it was great for me to be able to take Tim into some of those locations and really show him around. But in series two, we got to pretty much just do a wish list of places that we wanted to go and visit and somehow managed to make almost all of them happen. So tonight, for example, we'll be going to Charing Cross, which is a site I know very well. But I also got to go to the Kennington Loop, which is famous and infamous in London for, you know, people sometimes falling asleep on a Northern Line train and accidentally traveling through the Kennington Loop. But it's just an extraordinary part of town because Kennington is also one of the oldest deep level tube stations in London. So it has just these layers of history that we unpick on the show tonight. I mean, there are so many, Alex, it's hard to choose, but
I'm just looking, I'm particularly interested in your discovery of the long lost Marlborough Road Station, which I think is a sixth episode scenario. I mean, was that a bit like finding the original source of the Nile, perhaps?
Oh, you know what? Yes, it's so strange because Marlborough Road is not a station that I really had thought much of. And I actually used to live very close to it several years ago, probably 7 or 8 years ago. Passed it many times without even realizing it was an abandoned tube station. And so we got to go there and it kind of felt like being in, I don't know, like an abandoned temple or something, you know, like it was kind of overgrown, but still had this beautiful 19th century brickwork coming through. And then of course, the trains are rushing past and nobody sees that you're actually there, kind of hiding on the sidelines. So Marlborough Road was a real revelation and really took me by surprise, because I really didn't think there would be much to see there. But boy, was I wrong.
Just getting this sense and a real notion of you and Tim Dunn being a bit like Dor and Richard in Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere,
actually
sort of encountering these strange names in which there's a whole civilization that's actually buried underneath the whole side of things. There, it's fascinating.
Oh, it's a good analogy. Neverwhere is actually one of the, when I started doing this job at the museum, Neverwhere was the first book I read after I just got the job, and it wasn't even for any research purpose or anything. I just got given it randomly by a friend. So
it's, you mean to say, Sidi, you didn't have to sort of turn three times at Widdershins and actually then sort of work your way through London above to London below? It's astounding, really.
That's obviously how it happens today.
Yeah. The series itself, of course, is, launches today for that, probably works, of course, through May and June. How can people actually access it? How can actually people find out about these secrets of the London Underground?
Yeah, so the series is on tonight on the Yesterday channel at 8 p.m. And then we will be with you at 8 p.m. every Thursday for the next 10 weeks. But if you can't catch us on live, you could always go to UK TV Play and catch up online. So I hope you do join us tonight.
Indeed so. And I've got to ask the question, do you have a favourite station on the Tube network and in all the sort of range that we've actually got there ever since that wonderful map was overlaid and we sort of passed from strange sounding places to strange sounding names? Anyone that always stands out for yourself?
It's a very difficult question, because I think all of us have kind of maybe a few favorites, and they're normally ones that maybe we used to live by or traveled through a lot for work or something like that. So you've got a sentimental connection to it. For that point, there's the one that comes to mind to me is Elephant and Castle. It's a little grimy and it's a little inconveniently located, but what I like about it is that it's this kind of connection point between the old City and South London Railway, which was the first deep tube in London, and the Bakerloo line, which just has such a distinct kind of character of its own, and both lines feel so unique at that particular location.
Sounds great. I'm just thinking about the camera operators as well, basically, because they must have had fun actually following you into the whole action.
Oh my God, we had the best crew ever, because these are long shooting days. We're in such, they're very dusty places, so you get very thirsty sometimes. But honestly, we just had such a brilliant time making them. I mean, every day we were like kids in a candy store.
There you go, even if it's underground, but still. Sidi, it's been awesome connecting with you, good self. And of course, it's the Yesterday channel. You can access the wonderful Secrets of the London Underground series too. Do you think there's going to be a third season? There has to be, surely.
Well, let's see.
Secrets of the Paris Underground, Secrets of the New York subway. There's going to be mileage there, surely.
I mean, that would be fantastic. And I mean, we'd absolutely love to explore more. I think we've still got a few secrets left in London that we can explore for sure. I mean, it is a finite resource, of course, because there is only an X amount of network. But I think we've still got some amazing parts of London to explore. So who knows? Who knows?
Well, Sidi, it's been a terrific connection with your good self. We'll throw the usual two questions at you. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the midweek drive today? Has it been okay?
It's been great. Yeah, absolutely perfect.
In which case, then, the usual question is, can we look forward to connecting with you again? Will you be kind enough to return in the not-too-distant future with more magical news and information from the London Transport Museum?
Absolutely delighted to, Alex.
Call the terror of tomorrow, madmen on the rampage, and I'm down in a tube station at midnight. Change, pull out the queen, smiling, beguiling. I put in the money and pull out a plum behind me. Whispers in the shadows, rock blazing voices, hating, waiting. Hey, boy, hey, shout. Have you got any money? And I say, I've a little money and I take the white curry. I'm on the way home to my wife. She's been lining up the cutlery and now she's expecting me. Polishing her glasses and pulling out the cork. I'm down in a juice station at midnight. I first felt a fist and then a kick. Could now smell their breath, the smell of pubs and wormwood scrubs, and too many right-wing meetings. My life swam around me, it took a look and drowned me in its own existence. The smell of brown leather, even in with the weather, fill my eyes, his mother, mouth, and love till my senses could see. I'm down in a tube station at midnight. I said I'm walking down in a tube station at midnight. The last thing I know, so the lady there on the phone, Jesus says, fight it by, let the years never end. I'm pretty sure I'll bust a ring. Have I no way to die? A cheap holiday, a dream today. I've got stuck on my life. I took the keys, she'll pick it's me. I'm down in a tube station at midnight. The wine will be flat and the car is going cold. I'm down in a tube station at midnight. Don't wanna go, I'm down in a tube station at midnight. Don't wanna go, I'm down in a tube station at midnight.
I was riding my horse in the desert, tired and weary of mind, not knowing what I was searching for and not caring what I might find, when suddenly, there in the desert, my old buck stumbled, and to my surprise, he uncovered a world of dreams right before my eyes. There was an old tin cup, a battered old coffee pot, a saddle, a pick, and a spade. All that remained of the hopes of a miner and the wonderful plans he once made. A rusty old rim from the wheel of a wagon, the strings from a guitar he had played, giving mute testimony from an old 49er of the wonderful plans he once made. A handful of nuggets lay gleaming in the sun, right next to the gun he used to hold. You see, he had learned from a friend that the end of his rainbow was just a bag of fool's gold. An old tin cup, a battered old coffee pot, a good book from which he had prayed, telling the story of an old 49er, of the wonderful plans he once made. There was a faded picture of a girl there, too, in a pretty gingham dress, rested near a letter. A letter that told how a stranger had come along, taken her away, and her love for him had grown cold. Beside that old tin cup and battered old coffee pot, I knelt with his good book and prayed to the Lord, please take care of the old 49er and the wonderful plans he once made.
Ah, one more cup of coffee, eh? The coffee morning, the notion of having coffee and so on. What's happened to tea, though? Well, apparently coffee is fast becoming the nation's go-to afternoon beverage. So it's not so much a case of 11s, but more sort of coffee with all sorts of other areas, with an afternoon coffee menu specially being created as well. Who's created it? Well, only coffee expert extraordinaire and ace trainer Antonia Godwood. How are you, Antonia?
I'm really well, thank you, Alex.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self, Antonia. And clearly, you're working in partnership with the London School of Coffee. So this is some serious stuff that we're dealing with here.
Absolutely, but fun as well. Coffee can be serious, but also fun too.
Okay, now, clearly, there are many people who actually say they can't function with a couple of coffees in the morning. And I've often sort of said, no, that's just an Americanization. Of course you can get by. You know, just go with some water, etc. But what is it about the caffeine bean, the humble caffeine bean? And obviously there are huge variations in terms of so many coffees you can actually have that actually makes it something that's just growing in popularity and shows no sign of waning.
No, not at all. The industry is growing, especially in the UK at the moment, growing for a number of reasons. And we're almost coming away from that caffeine only perspective. We're actually, it's not just about your coffee on the go in the morning to get that caffeine hit. It's becoming, the dialogue is coming more about the flavor and actually that there is a lot more to coffee than just that original coffee campaign for caffeine that we had, you know, 20, 30 years ago. It's always evolving. And the questions are now coming that coffee is so much more than just that.
Now, again, looking at the statistics here, 3/4 of British folk like to eat something as well whilst enjoying their coffee in the afternoon. Now, is that just a kind of, it's a sugar fix you need, or is it something completely different? I mean, I noticed you've produced some mouthwatering treats with this afternoon coffee menu. Perhaps, Antonia, you'd like to just talk us through the top 6 things we've got here.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very, very exciting project where we teamed up with Nescafe Dolce Gusto and their pod machine for the home to explore that we compare flavours from coffee and pair it with savoury and sweet items, like a bit of an afternoon coffee menu as a new take on it. Just because we're acknowledging as well, you know, 85% of Brits are choosing coffee as their daily drink. Like you said, the 2/3 are now saying actually, we want to be enjoying something with that. So in the morning, you may have where your viennoiserie is, your croissants and your pain au chocolat. But the afternoon tea, a lot of places, and I've spoken to a lot of places that offer afternoon tea, and there are people that are saying, but we would prefer coffee with this. So we basically generated a menu that was designed around the pods that Dolce Gusto did. So for example, we chose one of the milky drinks, the Cafe au lait in the flat white pod, and I wanted to enhance the richness of the coffee flavor within that product. So we went with a tarte au chocolat, which is nice and rich, very deep, but because the flavor of the coffee has a lot of chocolatiness to it, but we wanted to bring out the richness where we've got the sweetness coming in with the milk of the drink. Equally, we can flip that over, and the Americano pod, which is actually, in terms of flavor analysis, it's got a little nuttiness to it. It's quite roasty. And we wanted to add a lightness to it. So we added a little honey sweetness because it's quite light. It's quite delicate. We did a honey pistachio and rose cake just to make it light and not too overly sweet, because not everyone has a diehard sweet tooth. So it was trying to find the balance within that and put the pairings together so people at home could have a bit of a journey and a bit of an experimentation with their cafe at home, as I like to call it.
So I was intrigued with the courtesan au chocolat. I mean, it sounds broadly decadent, that, really, Antonio.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, my courtesan au chocolat was something from my pastry days. Before I've been in the coffee industry for nearly 10 years now, but before then I was patisserie-based. And it was one of the things I developed in my cafe. I loved making them. It was choux pastry-based. And I actually got the influence or the inspiration from a film, which was the Grand Budapest Hotel. And I just loved these creations. And I was like, I've got to make these, I've got to recreate these. So I did. And I kind of try and roll them out because they look quirky and they're quite special. And they're a real treat. So a little decadent treat next to your coffee. And you can be very creative with it. There's no... patisserie is, I think we all know, can be very precise and beautiful. Professional pastry can be very precise. And I wanted something that was a bit more rustically creative that people can amend themselves at home to what they want.
Indeed. Now, I mean, you've shared with us your background in terms of pastry and so on. What drew you into the world of coffee to become a coffee expert from that point of view? Was it something you felt drawn to, or was it a case of, well, no, I really never wanted to go down the line of green and herbal tea?
No, it wasn't. I've never been a huge tea drinker. I started drinking coffee from quite a young age, influence from family in Europe that I have. But it was when I was in patisserie, I got to a point where I thought, you know, go for broke, have your own patisserie, your own little coffee house. And I had a coffee company, because I specialised in pastry from Vienna. And I had a company that helped me, and I got to see a lot of the coffee side and working with them. And as much as I loved having a cafe, my world was changing, and I was looking at this coffee going, this is amazing. And it opened my eyes that the industry was so much bigger than what I thought it was. And I got hooked. I couldn't leave it. I wanted to be part of it, the sustainability, the detail, the science of it. So I started taking qualifications to learn more, to develop my portfolio for the knowledge in the industry, really, and advocate for it.
Certainly seems as though we moved on an awful long way from the notions of the flat white, or indeed to commit to the ultimate sacrilege, the instant brand. So best not even go there.
I mean, there is a place for it. It has a part of the market for sure. But how we've grown as a country for more questions being asked, people want to know what they're putting in their bodies, and they want to know the provenance and the sustainability. It's becoming a very readily available topic to talk about, which is amazing. It's good for the industry.
Well, certainly the notion of shoe buns with cream cheese, cucumber, thyme and honey seems as though you're over-egging the pudding, to mix metaphors there.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one. That was good fun.
And it's paired with the Americano pod as well. It just sounds amazing. Antonia, people want to actually find out more details about the first coffee training facility in the UK, the London School of Coffee, and indeed Nescafe at Dolce Gustos. Where should they actually go?
For your recipes, especially if you've got a machine or you're looking at the pod machine, then Dolce Gusto are going to put all those recipes on their website. So you can have a little play, see how you find them. Equally, if you're wanting to learn more about coffee, it doesn't have to be professional, it can be just as an enthusiast, then London School of Coffee is your go-to, definitely.
Antonia, it's been fantastic connecting with the good self. We'll throw in two final questions. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Absolutely. Coffee in hand, it's all great.
Well, I was going to say, did you have the coffee to hand as well from that perspective? And clearly
always.
You do. Yeah. Excellent. So the next critical question is, can you come back again and join us sometime and keep us appraised of matters in the caffeine world?
Oh, I'd love to. Absolutely. I can talk about coffee all day, every day.